All right. I'm grateful that people made it out this morning after yesterday's snow, last night's snow. I was somewhat concerned. As always, thank you to the Bayit for hosting sessions in our Medical Ethics and Halacha series. This is part of the Nussbaum Family Medical Halacha and Ethics Institute, and our topic this morning is seeking psychological counseling. A few notes as we get underway. First of all, if you have a cell phone with you and you could please silence it, I would appreciate it. Thank you. Second, there are sign-in sheets. There are three of them around. They're probably somewhere on the middle of the table. I would ask in particular that anyone who wants to have credit for being here, if you want CME credit, please make sure that you sign in. If you already received the emails for this class, you do not need to add your email address, unless it's changed, obviously, but otherwise I have your email address, so that's okay. There's a third column on the sign-in sheet. That's for receiving information about other programs, non-medical programs. If you want to get other information about those programs, please check the box. If you don't, then please do not. I will, God willing, send out a link to an online evaluation form sometime in the next couple of days. The online evaluations are very important as part of the accreditation process. We need your feedback, so please do fill that out. In the event that you are not a medical professional, you don't have to check off the parts or answer the parts that deal with medical practice. As a matter of fact, you probably shouldn't. But still, it is important for us to have people do the evaluations. Last note under the logistics is that our next program is Monday evening, February 10th at Shari Shamayim. I'll be sending out information on it to the email list. Our topic is bereavement and the physician. And that's a topic that was actually requested when I called for topics last year. Someone asked me for that topic. And we're going to cover a whole range of items within that session, I expect. From the technical and practical, like if a physician is sitting Shiva, are they allowed to see patients, to questions of responsibility of a physician when a patient dies in their care, a whole range of topics under that. So that'll be Monday evening, February 10th. But again, our topic this morning is seeking psychological counseling. I'm defining psychology here in a pretty broad sense. I'm including here basic, you know, counseling, talk therapy, psychiatric treatment with medication as well, behaviorist approaches, CBT, DBT. I'm not really going to be discussing ECT and psychosurgery. That's really beyond what we're going to get to this morning, and certainly beyond anything I know anything about. So that far we're not really going. But some notes in terms of the session that we're going to have. First of all, we're accredited for 90 minutes, and I plan to use every one of them. But usually I like to build from primary sources a lot more, and you see what you'll see on the source sheets is that here I'm not doing that as much because there is so much to discuss in this field, and there's so much that's been written in terms of contemporary sources that I feel like have to be brought in as well. So often what you'll see on the sheets and what you'll hear in the discussion is coming from the contemporary sources, which do incorporate the primary ones. Two particularly useful texts to know about. This one is Judaism and Psychology, Halachic Perspectives, from Rabbi Dr. Moshe Halevi Spiro. It's written in 1980. It's a remarkable read on many levels. I just want to give you a little bit about the bio of the author. Moshe Halevi Spiro received his BA in Psychology and History from Case Western, an MSSW in Clinical Social Work at the School of Applied Sciences at Case Western, studied in the Beit Midrash of Tells, and received an MA in Psychology from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, where at the time he wrote this, he was a doctoral candidate in social work and psychology. There's more to the bio, but this is somebody who speaks from both sides in terms of his knowledge. He has classic yeshiva training. He also has a psychology side of it. Some of the writing is a little dense on the psychology side for someone who's not a psychologist like me, but that's good because it provides you with a lot of very good background information. And I'm I'm emphasizing it because, as you'll see on the source sheets, I use quite a bit of his material, and I think it's something people should be familiar with. I believe he lives in Israel today. The other is a very interesting book that I picked up last year, year before. Psychotherapia Viadut, also known as Psychotherapy in Judaism. But it's a collection of Hebrew essays and studies and responsa on psychology in Judaism, and psychotherapy in Judaism in particular, but really psychology in Judaism. The production values are awful. It is filled with typos and areas of layout where you look at it and say, why did they do that? But the content is gold. The content is fantastic. So I'm not going to pass it around during, because that will disrupt, you know, during the session, but I'm going to keep them up here. And afterwards, I always stick around to discuss and answer questions. If you want to take a look at them, I think it's definitely worth a look. I also gave you the titles at the top of the sheet, so you have them there. Last note of introduction here. I always say this, but it's especially true with what we're going to talk about this morning. Nothing I say should be construed as psak, as a halachic ruling on these issues. You're going to hear many voices quoted which are against Jews consulting psychologists, or against consulting psychologists who are not themselves observant Jews. Please do not go on that basis or recommend things to people on the basis of what you hear this morning. I think anyone who's dealing with this as a practical question, the question of whether they should seek help or from whom they should seek help or what sort of help they should seek, really should speak to a posek who understands psychology and its practice and knows their particular case to determine guidance that's appropriate for them. It is such a personal thing, it is such a case-dependent thing, that I think generalizations would be irresponsible. So I'm making sure to say that up front, and may well reiterate it as we go along, because it's something I strongly believe. Okay, so you see it on the sheet, three vignettes. I actually had five. I dropped the last two knowing we weren't getting there, and I feel like number three also probably we're not getting there, but, you know, aspirations are important in life. First one, Susan, an observant Jew, has been suffering from moderate depression for more than a year. She lives in a community where there are no observant therapists. May Susan seek help from a non-observant therapist? That's one question. I didn't give you details here, like how old is Susan, is this postpartum, or is this just general? I didn't give you any details like that. The fundamental question here is the propriety of seeking help from a therapist who is not personally an observant Jew. Second, Jason, an observant therapist, is treating a yeshiva student for anxiety. He feels the yeshiva student would benefit from the writings of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. What should Jason consider before introducing this material in a therapeutic setting? So we're going to deal with both of these and discuss both of these as we go through this. But the question at hand is what? Why is this a question? Sorry? Imposing his own values on the patient is one concern.
It's not validated therapy.
Sorry? It's not validated therapy. Okay. And what else? Alright, well, you know what? If I'm saying we're going to discuss it later, we're going to discuss it later. Let me not try to move the discussion early. There's a lot to be said. Sorry?
The halachic position.
Meaning?
Meaning, well, the non-observant. Can you go to a non-observant?
Oh, you're talking about the first one. You're on the first one, right. So we have to, right, so from a halachic perspective, correct. And then the, yeah.
It's a big room, and if anybody's speaking from that end,
right, that's a good point, is that I do try to repeat what people say for everybody, but you're right, I don't always do it. So I will also note that there are a couple of empty seats here on this side, so if anybody wants to move up, that option is still there. The last issue, again, I don't think we're going to get here, but I think it's an important question to think about, important enough that I left it on the sheet. Samantha, an observant therapist, is treating Julie, age 20, for issues stemming from low self-esteem. Samantha suspects that some of Julie's problems stem from an abusive father. May Samantha introduce this idea to Julie and encourage Julie to talk about her parents' role in her childhood? The question here is one that I've seen quite a bit of discussion about, the issue of kibud avim, of honoring one's parents, or violating that in the interests of therapy. So that's, again, I don't think we're going to get to that case. I'm planning a part two. The only question is when it's going to happen. The other vignettes that I have surround questions of a man going to a woman for therapy or vice versa, which is obviously its own question. And then another one for the therapist side of things, which is, what if you're asked to provide marriage counseling for a couple where their marriage would not be sanctioned by halacha? Let's say it is an intermarriage, or let's say it's a kohen who married a divorcee. You are now presented with this situation. Is it okay from a halachic perspective for you to offer counseling geared at supporting the marriage? If from a Jewish law perspective, actually, it would be better if the marriage were not supported. So that's its own question in its own right. Again, we ain't getting there. There are loads of questions that we'll have to wait for another session. Use of new treatments, treatments that maybe have controversial data. Questions that come up with specific illnesses, depression, OCD, dementia, stress-related, all sorts of other ones. Some of these I have discussed, actually, and you can find recordings on YU Torah. Maybe I'll send out in the follow-up email some links to some of those sessions that I've had, so that those who are interested can click on the link and hear. But the learning objectives that we have, as you see on the sheet, are pretty narrow. By the end of the session, participants will appreciate the ways in which modern psychology may challenge the beliefs of an observant Jewish patient, part of dealing with our first vignette, and be able to advise observant Jewish patients regarding pursuing psychological counseling in ways which are consistent with their personal beliefs. Okay. So we start. Your first principle in this has to be the obligation to seek medical help. In general, anytime somebody is in a situation where their health is threatened, there is a basic imperative of seeking medical help. Now, there are, to a certain extent, competing imperatives. Because on the one hand, the Torah tells us multiple times that God is the healer. Ani Hashem Rofecha, I am Hashem who heals you. You're supposed to trust in God. So therefore, I could make the argument that I'm not supposed to go to a doctor. On the other hand, the doctor has permission biblically to heal, as the Talmud deduces from the verse Verapo Yerape, when the Torah talks about what happens if one person assaults another. And it says that the assailant is responsible to pay all kinds of damages, including they're responsible to pay medical bills. The Talmud says the only way that the Torah could mandate that you pay someone's medical bills is if there are medical bills. So that indicates that there, in fact, is an endorsement from the Torah for people to treat, for people to provide medical treatment, as well as to charge for it, which is its own discussion. So that's number one. Number two, there is an obligation for people who know how to take care of those who are ill to actually do so. Right? That's your obligation. How do we know that there's an obligation to provide medical treatment, aside from the permission we've already seen? How do you know there's an obligation to provide it? Hashavas Aveda is one, as she points out. I think so. I didn't bring my driving glasses, but I think down at that end, that's Heshi. Hashavas Aveda, there's a requirement that if somebody loses their property and you find it, you restore it to them. Their health is certainly included within that. You have an obligation to restore their health to them. That's one source. Where else? Yeah. Ellen. Good. Ellen points out, "V'lo samod al dam reyecha, you shall not stand by while somebody else's blood is shed." If you are able to save somebody from harm, you have a duty to do so. Another source that's brought is, "V'ahavta l'reyecha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself." Not only a feeling of love, but you have to act on their behalf. So on the one hand, you're telling me rely on God as the healer. On the other hand, you're telling human beings that they should seek healing and that they and that the doctor is obligated to provide it. Indeed, Ramban, Nachmanides, argues both sides. In his commentaries to the Torah, when he talks about relying on prophets, I didn't bring it on the sheet, when he talks about relying on the Navi, relying on a prophet, he says you're not supposed to seek help from human beings, you're supposed to look for your help from God. However, Ramban, Nachmanides, has another work called Tarat HaAdam, in which he provides an awful lot of information on medical halacha, and there he writes that there is a biblical commandment for the doctor to heal. So how can you tell the patient to rely on God and then tell the doctor you're obligated to heal people? Does that mean that the doctor has to run down the street with a stethoscope, right? Or we're discussing psychology, so run down the street with a book and you know, calling after the patient, wait, I'm supposed to treat you. Like, how exactly is that supposed to work? Yeah.
This is that Hashem is giving the doctor the wisdom to know how to heal.
Right, so one way to do it is to approach medicine and say, well, the medicine is ultimately empowered by God, and therefore I am effectively going to God for help by going to the doctor. Some doctors might find that inappropriately flattering, and some might actually say that's correct.
Is there a place in hell for shochets and
doctors? Only for the best doctors, the Gemara says. Tov shebarofim legehenim. That's true. The Gemara does say the best doctors go to Gehinom. That's a topic for another time. It really isn't one that... I'm actually serious about that. From a time perspective, except to note that there are multiple explanations there, and one of them is that this is out of a concern for arrogance, for the doctor who decides, I am really good at this, and this is all coming from me, and who errs because of that arrogance. But there's more to be said about that. There's a physician of the Chida who wrote that the doctor is obligated to heal, but the patient isn't supposed to want to go, which is interesting. The Tzitz Eliezer, though, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, gives what I think is the classic position. I brought it here on the sheet in source number 2. In all the sources here, I brought you the original Hebrew for authenticity, but I'm going to read out the English because of time. So you have the original there. He says, Ramban's words there are stated regarding the foundation of things at their root. When he says you should rely on God and not go to people, he says, yeah, when there are no external factors. However, since almost the great majority of people do not merit healing via miracles from heaven, and the Torah itself says not to depend on miracles, this permission, meaning the permission to heal, applies to patients as well. Meaning it isn't just permission for doctors to heal, it's permission for patients to seek treatment. Further, it is a mitzvah and obligation, since life depends on it. Once you're allowed to pursue healing, you have an obligation to do so. And certainly, we have this in halacha when you get to issues of life and death, right? The Shulchan Aruch talks about how somebody on Yom Kippur says, I don't need to eat, I insist on fasting, and the doctor says, no, you need to eat. The halacha is we have that person eat. We do everything possible to convince that person to eat because the doctor says you need to. So clearly we are trusting medical opinion. Rav Moshe Feinstein deals with this as well in source number 3, where he talks about conflict regarding life-saving treatment, where the patient refuses it and the doctor says, I know this will work. I'm not getting into discussions about medical assistance in dying and end of life treatment and so on right now. The Ramosha's position is that if the doctors really believe that this will work, that the patient does not have the right to refuse it. So the first principle and what we establish at the outset is that there is an obligation to seek medical help. Based on that alone, I would have argued, well, this is easy then. If a person is suffering from mental, emotional dysregulation, they're in a position where they're not able to manage themselves, and certainly where that's leading to a debilitating situation and potentially a threat to life, of course they would be obligated, right? We could end this 90 minutes now. But the answer is no, it's not that simple. And it's not that simple for multiple reasons. But when you're dealing with the area of psychology, there are certain problems. Now, what we're going to see involves a lack of trust in the application of psychology for a variety of reasons, as as you're going to see, as we're going to go through. But I want to make sure to emphasize something here. Lack of trust in the application of psychology is not the same thing as a lack of recognition of mental illness and its impact. Meaning, the sources that we're going to see, which are going to say, no, don't go to psychologists or don't go to non-observant psychologists, none of them are going to say psychology is quackery. None of the, even though they're written during a time in history when psychology is just in development, you're going to see a lot from the middle of the 20th century where there are those who are arguing that this new thing is not a real science, it's not something that is testable and so forth. That's not really what you get in the Jewish literature on this. What you get instead is a concern about the application of psychology to mental illness. Now, sometimes what you will see is that halachic authorities are operating with a misunderstanding of psychology or an outdated understanding of what psychology does. If you take a look at source number 4, this is from Rabbi Dr. Spiro's book. He says, in past studies of the basic relationship between psychology and Judaism, writers grappled with the conflict between, quote, secular psychology and, quote, Torah psychology, between a science construed as valueless, amoral, yet committed to the value of unlicensed instinctual expression and behavioral determinability, and without interest in the real relationship between man and God, juxtaposed against a way of life permeated with values, anti-instinctual, bound to a belief in limitless human freedom and the need for human transcendence. A lot of syllables, but you understand what he's saying. Psychology was characterized as being without values, as being amoral, as just being about getting the servir instincts, about determinism, that there's no such thing as free will, no relationship between man and God, and then the Torah on the other side. It's about the Torah Chavshus, having free will, there are values, don't follow your instincts. He says, previous literature reinforces this unhelpful conception of psychology and halacha as two separate realities locked in conflict. This is an unhelpful conception of what psychology is about and, frankly, what halacha is about. It does a disservice to both sides. You find quite a bit the argument that psychology believes that if you give people their desires, you'll make them happy and therefore healthy. Now, I see people who practice psychology, at this table. Would you accept that characterization of psychology? Give people, a lack of responsibility for their, for their actions and a feeling of happiness, and we're good?
There was a California mantra: if it feels good, do it.
Yeah, but is that a fair read of psychology?
No,
I generally not. Right? That was my assumption. But if you take a look at number 5, Reb Moshe Sternbach, a major halachic authority in the latter half of the 20th century, he says, I spoke, he's addressing somebody in a letter, he says, I spoke against the local practice in which many religious men and women, when their nerves are shaken or they are sunken in depression, etc., go to psychologists. Their method of healing is to speak with a patient, to investigate with him what he is lacking, and they seek to give the patients what they desire, thereby healing them. Let them have what they want, and then they'll be okay. I think it's a misunderstanding of what the treatment is. Rabbi Yuval Shurlo wrote a piece called "Ethika Shel Metapel Dati," or an ethics for an observant therapist. And he is responding to a piece by Rabbi Eliezer Melamed in Israel. Both of them are contemporary. They both write today. So Rabbi Melamed's words consist of two parts. First, he says that parts of psychoanalysis liberate a person from responsibility for his actions. But it appears to me that the true meaning of all practical psychology, including psychoanalysis, is the opposite. The goal of treatment is to enable a person to take responsibility for his actions. So he's giving you a very different view of what is happening. One more quote just along these lines in terms of the misconceptions of psychology. Take a look at source number 7. This is from a very harsh article regarding going to psychologists. Rabbi Menachem Froman. It appeared just, you can see, 12 years ago. Ha-psychologia ha-arura hitatanu. Now, those who know Hebrew may be a little stunned by the harshness of the language, but what he's doing is it's a quote. The title it's not really a quote, it's changing a phrase. The Vilna Gaon was very against the study of philosophy. And he wrote about the Rambam, Ha Philosophia Ha Arura Hitato. The accursed philosophy misled the Rambam. So what Rabbi Froman is doing is he's borrowing that and saying, accursed psychology has fooled us, has misled us. And he writes, the main problem is expressed in its anthropocentrism. If you want to know how to spell anthropocentrism in Hebrew, you could just look at the Hebrew right here, if you ever wanted to know. The fact that it locates man in the center of the stage with all attention on him. The idea that it's all about the man and all about the human being and what the human being wants. And again, this is not necessarily an accurate read. So one issue that you deal with when you look at the literature on going to psychologists is you have to make sure that the author who's writing is writing about the same psychology that you're talking about. Whatever it was they were dealing with, wherever this information came from, it clearly doesn't have global application to the way psychology is practiced today. So that's something that you really need to take into consideration. Nonetheless, having said that and having noted the importance of having an accurate read on what we're talking about in terms of psychology, there are three particular concerns regarding going to a psychologist from the perspective of Jewish law. So before I say what I think the three concerns are, I'm going to ask you, what might be the legitimate considerations when you're talking about having somebody seek psychological counseling in general or in particular from a non-observant practitioner?
Like a misunderstanding of our religious, like our religion and how we do things may be interpreted by a secular psychological therapist as being particularly unusual.
Right.
Or not.
Right, you have to be familiar.
Pathological OCD, whatever you want to say.
Yeah, no, and it comes up with OCD. It absolutely comes up. In a lot of the OCD literature, you see the emphasis on, and not just with Judaism, but any religion, you see the emphasis on understanding what is normal within that society in order to recognize when something is unusual. Right? I mean, you don't need me to tell you, but if someone were to describe the steps I take when I tie my shoes in the morning, or when I wash my hands, you'd look at that and say, well, that's unusual and bears investigation, but, you know, the answer is no. I'm just following this. These are the rituals, and that's not an indication of ill health. So that's for sure a consideration. Yeah, Sheldon.
What Judaism may understand is a spiritual problem, psychiatry may not, and therefore you're going to the wrong address.
So Sheldon says, look at what the view of what the problem is at all. Judaism may characterize something as a spiritual issue, whereas psychology may take it as a psychological issue. Do you want to expand with an example? Because I could see a couple of different ways to go with that. You don't have to. No? So one way you could go with that is that emotional issues are certainly nothing new, and spiritual issues are certainly nothing new. And historically, before the development of modern psychology, people often went to their rabbi. There is an awful lot of literature in Judaism on dealing with issues that look an awful lot like what is today called depression. There was a lot of literature on that. Whether you know, it always worked, whether it's for everybody, whether it would be recommended today, isn't really my point. But we have a history, we have a tradition of going to rabbis for this sort of thing. And to take a person out of that, may raise eyebrows and may raise concerns. There's more you can do with that. What else? What other concerns might there be? Yeah.
Well, the one you brought up before, the keep it out of aim.
What about where contemporary therapeutic methods recommend activities which run counter to halacha? Right? What if the therapist really does believe, in the vignette that I gave, the therapist really does believe that the problem lies in the relationship with the parents, and that in fact there was, if not abuse, you know, if not abuse in the criminal sense, but maybe there is a belief that there was a verbally abusive relationship, and that has to be brought out and discussed in order for the patient to be able to get past that. That may well be the advice of a therapist. This comes up in a lot of different contexts. That's not the only one. Yes?
In that same vein, you can have the child, especially with teenagers, who, you know, are really seeking their own identity, and they're going into behaviors that to the parents he's been sorero more, really bad. And yet, you know, in a sense, this child's probably normal, but he's being told that he's bad. Mm-hmm. And he may feel that he needs that kind of counseling because he doesn't know, is he really bad or is he just being himself?
Right, and I think that's an important point. There are behaviors which, from the standpoint of society and psychology, are considered normal and healthy, which halacha says, no, you're not allowed to engage in that. And what the message that the teenager is getting at home or in school, maybe a message that the psychologist is going to disagree with and feel is in fact unhealthy. So they can be at odds with each other. Anyway, with Ari down there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, apparently, if I have a frequently abusive problem, maybe an alcoholism or a mental illness can affect the child as well.
This is for sure true. The parent themselves may be ill, but there I wouldn't see that as a problem of pitting halacha against psychology, meaning halacha would also like that diagnosed and dealt with.
Yeah.
David.
Yeah. Both the Torah and psychology have a lot to say about what degree of things like guilt or control or aggression are acceptable and what isn't.
Mm-hmm. Also true. To take the first one, take guilt. Right? How in the world could you have Judaism without guilt? That doesn't even make any sense. In all seriousness, there is a healthy taking of responsibility, which I think everybody in Judaism and in psychology are going to endorse. You know, even if the application of it in particular situations may vary. But you will find schools within Judaism that are very strong in accepting and developing a sense of guilt for one's actions in the area where psychology may feel, you know what, you've gone too far, and maybe that is in fact unhealthy. And I'm not talking about what was mentioned in one of the sources before, a sense of no responsibility for one's actions, but there are levels. And there may be disagreement regarding those levels. So all of these are true. I think there's more to be said. I'm actually going to go a little further at this point because there is a lot to talk about in this regard. I would put most of the things that have been said in three camps, three areas of concern. The first area of concern is that, this is the most vague of the three, by going to a psychologist, you put contemporary psychology ahead of Torah as a resource. That's number one. Number two, concern that contemporary psychology may oppose halacha, directly or indirectly, like the honoring the parents case. And then third, that even if the psychology itself is fine, the psychologist who doesn't believe as we do, could have a destructive influence. Those are, to me, the three major categories of concern, and I want to explore them one by one. First of all, putting contemporary psychology ahead of Torah as a resource. As we've already said, Judaism has historically viewed Torah as sam hachayim, right? The medication that provides life, the cure for psychological issues, the cure for behavioral issues. So offering any other approach is automatically fraught. The same concern existed in Ramban when he talked about physical problems. A person has a physical illness and he wasn't so sure you should go to doctors and presented us with conflicting views. But it becomes even stronger here because it's so easy to conflate religious ills with psychological ills. Right? It's so easy for the two to go together. in our own minds. Meaning, you have a kid who is, he's in college. Let's say he's already in college. He stops getting up in the morning for minyan. He gets up at 10 o'clock, 10:30, 11 o'clock, whatever it is in the morning. His parents are worried. If you're pre-20th century, what do? You talk to his Rebbe, right? You talk to his Rebbe from yeshiva. You talk to the rabbi, and you try to get some advice, something that will catalyze interest in him in going to shul. And whatever that's going to look like depends on your school. Maybe one will offer books of Musar, another one will offer encouragement, another one will offer a 10 o'clock minyan. Whatever it's going to be. It depends on where you're going for your advice. But fundamentally, that's what you did historically. Right? I can't get out of bed for shul. Okay, so we have ways of dealing with this, trying to encourage it, whatever it is. You know, today it might be, you know what, maybe we need to address, is he afraid of the day? Is there something that's bothering him? Is there some source of stress? Is there anxiety? Is it something in the shul setting? Is it conflict about religion? Is it, you know, it's a whole different way to look at things.
Is it that age group has a different time schedule?
Yes, circadian rhythms, right. And no, in all seriousness, they absolutely true. All of these are true. Is he staying up too late at night? Why is he staying up so late at night? What is he doing when he's up late at night? All sorts of other questions come into play. But the point is that you're shifting things away from the classic Torah basis. If you take a look at source number 8, I brought you from the Rambam, from Maimonides, no stranger to medicine, but keep in mind, he's in 12th century Egypt, where the conception of the difference between a psychological issue, an emotional issue, and a spiritual issue, there is no barrier between those at that point. So he says, those who are physically ill taste bitter as sweet and sweet as bitter. Some patients desire and crave inedible foods. So people whose souls are ill, and I use the word souls to translate nefashot here because I didn't see another good way to translate it. You could say psyches if you wanted. But so people whose souls are ill desire and love wicked ideas and hate the good path and are lazy about walking it. And it is very hard for them in accordance with their illness. What is the way to cure those whose souls are ill? They should go to sages who are healers of souls, and they will hear their illnesses through deot. Deot doesn't have a good translation in English. It's perspectives, ideas, points of view. Sorry?
Concepts.
Teaching them until they restore them to the good path. It doesn't seem to me that he is referring to doctors here. It sounds to me from his language that he is referring to something rabbinic. That is the way I read what the Rambam is saying here. Contemporarily, go back to Rav Sternbach in source number 9. We quoted him before. He says, the right path is to go to healers of souls, which are righteous people and giants of Israel, to show them the path and teach them to trust in God and to explain to them that God's will is always for the good and a little suffering pushes off much punishment in eternal life. He says spiritual counseling is the way to go. But it gets more complicated than this, because it's not really rabbis versus psychologists. It's the patient who feels the conflict. The patient feels the conflict. Why do I need to go to a psychologist? Does that mean that I have failed spiritually? One of the articles in this book, Psychotherapy and Yahadut, I'm just going to say it that way. I can't do the Hebrew version of it. Psychotherapia. But one of the articles in here is by a woman by the name of Esther Hess. And she writes an article called, as you see the title, Lihyot Mitupal Charedi, to be a Charedi patient. She did a lot of work on providing treatment and creating therapeutic environments in a Haredi community and what they could do to make these environments less frightening and less upsetting so that people would actually use them. And she writes about the problems that people face in a Haredi community. When you say Haredi, that can mean a lot of different things to different people, but what she means is Bnei Brak. That's what she's talking about.
They go to a woman?
Women would.
A woman would.
a woman would. She talks about that. She talks about the gender issues and men going to women and women going to men and what you can do about it. It's a very good article. So one of the things she notes here in source number 10 is the following. And if we are dealing with a Haredi patient, the fact that there is a need for therapy can be seen by the patient himself and even his inner circle as failure in tests. I must have been tested and failed. And in other religious solutions, which are accepted means of dealing with difficulty or trouble, like prayer, rabbinic blessing, spiritual strengthening, accepting special practices, and so on, you feel like, I failed. I should have been able to handle this in a religious environment. There must be something wrong with me. That's the feeling that one may get. She talks about what can be done to try to mitigate that. One of the things that she talks about that I think is very important is for rabbis to speak the lingo of psychology, to incorporate that so that it's normalized. The idea of going to somebody becomes less of a sign of failure. Yes. Yeah.
Rejection of religion due to illness, or are we dealing with mental illness? I'm not sure.
Well, I'm looking at it from the perspective of mental illness.
I know, but the topics that seem to be spoken here are someone who chooses not to be just as religious as that seems to be.
If you go back to Rabbi Sternbach's piece in number 9, go back to number 5, which was the beginning of his letter. Right? When their nerves are shaken or they're sunken in depression. He's not talking about people who are having religious difficulties.
Yeah. Okay,
so no, we're talking about mental illness.
Okay, not rejection of...
Correct. Okay. I use that as one of my cases. The guy's not going to Minyan. Just to highlight the way that people would normally go to a religious authority, but the same thing would have been true classically if people were dealing with depression. They also would have gone to a religious authority before the advent of modern psychology. I'm seeing two hands. Yeah.
The comment, I heard of cases, or seen cases where people will go to a religious authority for guidance when really the religious authority has no, it's beyond their scope of understanding. It's like, you know what, you need a psychiatrist in certain cases, and unfortunately these cases can be very, very...
Yes. We are coming to that. We are coming to that. If you want a really, really good piece on that, it is coming up in... Rabbi Wolbe, it's coming up, but it's coming up in a while. Number 44. If anyone ends up leaving early, take the sheets and read 44 because it's a must on that point about rabbis who misunderstand what they're seeing. But this is a concern. This is a real concern, even though you can't point to a particular halacha. You can't point to a particular law that says Torah must be your first point that you go to. Nonetheless, it's a sense. And it's a strong sense, it's a built-in sense, I should be able to handle this within the framework of Torah. Now, Rabbi Dr. Spiro believes that that this can be mitigated. Because he argues, and this is sort of like what you said before, that psychology can be viewed as a product of Torah. He makes the argument, based on something said by Ramban, that everything in the universe... is rooted in Torah. By definition, istaka b'araisa u'bara alma. God looked at the Torah and created the world. So everything in the world has its roots within Torah. And therefore he says, good psychology is always going to have its roots within Torah. And if there's something that contradicts Torah, well, that's a problem for psychology. That means psychology is wrong. That's his resolution of the problem. You can see I brought part of it in number 11. By the interest of time, I'm skipping reading it aloud. But that's his view. You can see the italics, which are in the original. He says, the halachic a priori, known to us only in the form of the concrete halacha of the written and oral law, serves as the basis for all reality, such that all participants in reality have an essentially halachic nature. And he quotes you, Ramban, everything that exists is fundamentally part of that, and therefore you should be able to argue that psychology is part of Torah. You're not looking outside of Torah for treatment. You're looking in Torah for treatment. The problem with that, of course, is that that's an abstract distinction. At the end, I didn't walk into the rabbi's office, I walked into the doctor's office. And so it's hard for people to wrap their minds around it. Yes?
Well, I think situations where the
you know, the Torah will forbid a behavior and didn't particularly generate that sexuality, that, you know, the Torah will, you know,
yeah, and he will argue that that's a defect in psychology.
You have an Orthodox person who finds, you know, thinks he's gay or what, and he doesn't know how to deal with it. How does he, you know, if he's going to go to a rabbi, he's probably going to be told that he's sinning or he's
right.
terrible. And
right. So the question was raised, or the point was made, I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Barbara.
So Barbara makes the point that there are areas where contemporary psychology will absolutely be at loggerheads with halacha. She mentions the issue of homosexuality, which earns a chapter in Spiro's book. And it's true. It's absolutely true that they're going to be in conflict. But he will argue that that's a deficiency in psychology, not a statement that all psychology is not in Torah. That's his application of it. We'll see a little bit more about that because we're going to get to a quote from him on that in number 13, so just wait. But that's your first concern, is I should be going to a rabbi, I shouldn't be going to a doctor. The second concern is that contemporary psychology may well oppose halacha directly or indirectly. You have to remember the passage of the Gemara, which I brought you in number 12, which says, "Bakol misrap in, one may be healed with anything." By which it means you can violate halacha in order to heal somebody. Obviously, it depends on the level of illness and so on. There is a whole hierarchy of types of illness and which prohibitions can be violated in order to take care of the person who is ill. But the Gemara here is dealing with a life and death case. And it says you can heal somebody in a life and death scenario using prohibitions except for idolatry, sexual immorality, and bloodshed. Not those. Even if you're dealing with a life or death circumstance, you're not allowed to heal somebody with one of these three cardinal sins, so to speak. And that's where you run into problems, because sometimes, in fact, certainly in the area of sexual immorality, what the Torah deems sexual immorality is not going to be recognized as such in psychology. Yeah, psychology is fundamentally concerned, certainly the way the DSM is written today, it's fundamentally concerned with that which is abnormal for society, or that which is maladaptive, not that which is inconsistent with halacha or Jewish belief. So take a look at number 13 from Spiro. He says, he's talking about the issue of homosexuality in particular as an example, and the APA statement that it's not an illness. He says, a more pivotal issue, however, appears to have been the statistical one, i.e., since the evidence favored by the APA held that homosexuality was merely a sociological artifact, meaning the label, could it still be considered a deviant sexual orientation? The decision of the APA was clearly a response to this question. An important issue begged by this decision is whether the frequency of a constellation of behaviors says anything about its inherent normal or abnormal status. This issue was made obsolete by the prior convention, replacing the medical term sickness, and certainly the concept of sin, with more libertarian terms such as maladaptive and inappropriate when describing pathology. Since it had already been accepted that, quote, deviance is not inherent in, but conferred upon, all standard pathologies are potentially capable of being reabsorbed into the normal end of the continuum when sufficient evidence presents itself. Right? He's making a factual statement here, which is, halacha has a different way to evaluate behavior, and I'm not going into a discussion of homosexuality right now. We will never discuss anything else. We'll spend the entire rest of the time on that without resolution. But his point is a more general point, using homosexuality as an example. Once you take the view that that which is normal in society, that which is done, not normal, using the word to define itself, that which is done within society is normal, acceptable, not considered deviant, and therefore not something to be treated at all, not something to be removed at all, you're going to be running counter to halacha, because that's not the way halacha works. You could envision a society in which 99.9% of people do X, which halacha prohibits. Halacha's still going to say you're not allowed to do it. So that's where you run. That's where you're going to run into trouble. Further, psychology promotes an outlook, which is different from the Torah-based outlook. And this is really more an issue of hashkafa, of outlook, but it has halachic applications to it. What I mean by that is best expressed based on source number 14. The Gemara in Brachos, classic story. Rav Huna quoted Rav quoting Rabbi Meir, and so was taught quoting Rabbi Akiva. One should always be accustomed to say, all that God does is done for the good. Right? Koman David Rachman Latav Avid, or as it's frequently worded, Gamzu Latofa. Like when Rabbi Akiva was traveling on the road and he reached a town, sought a host, but wasn't given one. He said, all that God does is for the good. He went and slept in the wild. He had a rooster, donkey, and lamp with him. Wind came, extinguished the lamp. A cat came and ate the rooster. A lion came and ate the donkey. This wasn't funny to him. He said, all that God does is for the good. That night, armed men came and sacked the town, right? And he wasn't detected because the donkey didn't bray and the candle wasn't lit. He told his students, have I not told you all that God does is for the good? And that's not just a story in the Talmud. That is taught from a very young age, to believe that whatever happens, there is a plan for it, there is a reason for it, there are benefits to it, and even if you don't know why, it's for the best. So look at what Esther Hess has to say in the essay I quoted before. Look at number 15. Addressing another problem for someone who is Haredi, in her case, and is going to therapy. A no less substantive aspect is the subject of conversation during sessions. May I, as a patient, feel pain and complain about my situation? Is this not denial of all of the good that Hashem has given me until now? We recognize the rituals which surround a believer. Baruch Hashem, all is from heaven, right? In treatment, such declarations are left on the side, and a substantive window is opened for deeper inner investigation. In the space that is created, questions may arise, and perhaps doubts and wonder, right? You reach a point where the person is going to feel uncomfortable saying what the psychologist feels they actually need to say. You need to reach a stage of acceptance. How are you going to reach acceptance when you're not willing to acknowledge that there's even something wrong? That there's something that isn't, so to speak, as it should be. Rabbi Yaakov Ariel points this problem out. He's also not a fan of much of psychological treatment. I brought you the Hebrew in number 16 at the bottom of one page, the English at the top of the next slide. Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, this is Dr. Seymour Hoffman, or Schneier Hoffman, is one of the principal authors of this book, and that's where I got this quote. Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, chief rabbi of Ramat Gan, sharpened this point, saying, the problem is that the psychologist suggests the patient to make shalom with reality, while the rabbi suggests that he make reality more shalem. I left the Hebrew, shalom and shalem, because I liked the turn of phrase. Shalom, peace. Shalem, whole. That which is complete. So the psychologist is saying, make peace with reality. The rabbi says, no, work to improve reality. Now, that's an unfair characterization on both sides. But, again, this goes back to what I said before about the simplification, oversimplification, potentially, of psychology. But his point is valid, I think, in terms of the perspective that people bring to psychological treatment. So we have this concern that psychology is going to oppose halacha or the outlook of Judaism directly or indirectly. Number one, because it's concerned with that which is maladaptive or abnormal, not that which is inconsistent with halacha. Number two, it promotes an outlook that says that the world has real problems in it. It looks towards an acceptance of reality where the Torah does not necessarily. And then, also within this same issue, psychology assumes that behavior can be traced to particular causes. Now, I think that's a fair statement. Frankly, I think it's a halachic statement also, but we're going to get to that. But psychology assumes that behavior can be traced to particular causes, and there's a lot of literature on that specific point as a conflict between halacha and psychology, because psychology is viewed as deterministic. The idea that there is no free will. What you're going to do is predictable by a good psychologist with enough information about what your issues are, and and that you don't have free will, and free will is, of course, in a fundamental principle within Judaism. I didn't bother to bring sources on it because it's one that's so classic. The Torah commands, "Uvacharta b'chayim," you shall choose life, suggesting that you have the ability to choose. The Rambam writes at length about the importance of free will as an underpinning without which you couldn't have reward and punishment and right and wrong within Judaism. And so many say that contemporary psychology is at the opposite end with a deterministic approach. I brought you one example from source number 17, from Spiro. Elaborating on the gravity of this problem, one halachically observant practitioner noted, he's quoting a fellow by the name of Kahn, who I gave you in the source. The issue of psychic determinism has possibly provided the main area of philosophical contention between psychology and religion. Psychic determinism is found in practically all areas of psychology. It has therefore become the cornerstone of scientific psychology, not only in experimentation and research, but also in theory building. And then he quotes a rabbi who is also, I believe, a psychologist. Amsel has taken the extreme view that this paradox is not only real, but irreconcilable, and that all forms of, quote, secular psychology, including psychoanalysis, behaviorism, ego psychology, etc., must in effect be abandoned by the faithful, quote, Torah psychologist. What do you say? I open the floor to you on this. Is this really a conflict that cannot be resolved?
How about the serenity prayer?
Meaning? I know what the serenity prayer is, but yeah.
So, there's a place for looking at it from a deterministic point of view. There's a place for no.
Okay, so in other words, what Mark is suggesting is that there's a place for, well, what he said, is that there's a place for looking at it from a deterministic point of view, and then there's a place for not doing so. And in fact, as in the Serenity Prayer, which isn't a Jewish thing, but looking to God for help to break through, that's what I assume you mean, to break through what may well be a set of behaviors that are predicted by a set of beliefs and so on. But I'm asking in particular the psychologists around the table here, is modern psychology that deterministic, that it doesn't believe that there's room for free will?
Some of the sources you're giving are old.
Exactly.
On psychoanalysis and stuff like that, we move quite far, at least some of us, because in cognitive behavioral and all kinds of other therapies, and not necessarily deterministic.
Right.
Rabbi Sachs in this week's Parsha talks very much about the whole of science being a project to find deterministic sources for everything.
Interesting. That it's all about trying to... Well, I think that... I mean, science looks for cause and effect, and I think that's a fair statement. David?
I read that when I was first starting out, and I found it very disturbing, by the way.
Yeah.
And I spoke to somebody about it. But if you actually go even back to Freud, he describes the role of psychoanalysis as where it was, ego shall be.
Mm-hmm.
Goal is for the individual to take control of their destiny. Destinies that are being tossed around by anonymous forces within them.
That's funny, because David points out that even within Freud, you can see things that are not deterministic. It's funny because Freud is always brought as the example of somebody who is deterministic. I am not an expert at all, and so I'm relying on everybody here to educate me. Take a look at number 18, because if you want to see somebody who really believes this, Rabbi Froman, who we quoted earlier, writing in 2008, says, like their predecessors, meaning the philosophers, they, psychologists, also create a disconnect between the soul and its divine root, seeing the soul not as a single, infinite, spiritual entity which can be influenced by conversation. I wasn't sure if the next word should be translated as expression or experience, so I give you both. And illumination, but a collection of conflicting desires, some say a collection of chemicals, which one may organize and control such that they will not reach conflict and explosion. An organization which one may regulate by adding a dose of medicine, hypnosis, or conditioning. He's absolutely of the belief that psychology is taking a deterministic approach, and and can't be reconciled with the Jewish concept of free will. Now, not everybody believes that these are irreconcilable. Spiro offers a few options. One option, he says, is be a pragmatist, right? Especially within behaviorism, right? Just say, okay, look, it doesn't matter at the end of the day whether they have free will or not. I have to treat them anyway. And so I'm going to engage in the techniques which have been shown to work without concern for the philosophical roots that drive them. The problem, as he points out, with that solution is that, number one, having a halachically valid grasp of the underlying theory can be important. Number one. And number two, if you drop the theory, then the only basis for your work is your clinical experience. And that's a dangerous thing in and of itself. So he's not sold on that idea. He brings, and I gave you references here at number 19 because I didn't want to spend the session on this piece of it, but he has a long discussion of other ways to try to reconcile this that I find less or more convincing. Before he comes to the conclusion, which I think is really what matters most, which is, it's a myth to say that Judaism is not deterministic. It's true that Judaism believes in free will. However, halacha accepts a degree of predictability for human behavior, and even you could call it determinism. We have concepts in Judaism like the shota who's not held responsible because they are not sane. In the case of the shota, the legal term, they're not sane. We have the case of ones, the idea that there are factors which in fact put a person in position of being not responsible for their actions. He talks about the ben sorer umora, which was mentioned before, where there is a fear, as ben sorer umora is read by various commentators, is a fear that a youth who gets himself into a path of theft and addiction is never going to be able to break out of it and is in fact going to end up with a terrible end. These all speak to the idea that there is indeed a degree of predictability and determinism, even as Judaism accepts and promotes the idea of free will. Tinok Shenishba, although there it's a practical circumstance that leads to it as opposed to a psychological one. But yes, the Tinok Shenishba, he was never educated, therefore he's not going to end up embracing Judaism. But this is a concern. The concern for the outlook being in conflict with Judaism and opposing the general underpinnings of halacha. And then there are the cases we mentioned before in which psychology directly recommends something that halacha prohibits. So we mentioned the issue of honoring one's parents. We didn't discuss that in depth and whether halacha would accept speaking about one's parents in therapy. We're not going to get to it, but I will say, because we're not going to get to it, I will note that Rav Nachum Rabinovich and others endorse, within certain bounds, but endorse the idea of speaking about one's parents in therapy where it's necessary therapeutically, where it's done responsibly, where the therapist understands that not everything the therapist is told is actually true. True in the objective sense. True to this person, but not true in the historical reality sense. The point is, there's a concern for Lashon Hara, and it's accepting Lashon Hara and so forth. My point is to say, don't take the fact that I've mentioned honoring parents as an example, as a statement that, yeah, you can't talk about parents in therapy. That's not what I'm saying.
Didn't the Rambam say that if your mother is driving you crazy, as long as you make sure that she's got shelter and food, you can move to another town?
So what the Rambam said based on the Gemara is that you could hire somebody to take care of her. He didn't just say shelter and food. But that's not the same as saying, and then you can go to the bar and talk to your friends about her. Or to the doctor and talk to your friends about her. But this is, that's one example. Another example that comes up in this book, fascinating question. You have somebody who has fears. He has anxieties that bad things are going to happen to him because they have been stated, because he said them. And the therapist says, I want you to actually say something, that something bad is going to happen to you, something bad is going to happen to your children, as a means of desensitizing them, as a means of them seeing that, in fact, what you say does not necessarily come to pass. But we have principles of al-tiftach pe'la satan. You're not supposed to open up your mouth literally for the satan. We do assign significance to a person's speech. This does matter in Judaism. So how do you deal with it? And that's another reason why there's a lot of suspicion surrounding going to a psychologist, because of that fear. Mind you, I brought you a number 20 that it isn't true that that's an automatic thing. Often these things can be dealt with without violating halacha. This is, for those who aren't here, when I spoke about OCD a bunch of years ago, I brought this source then. It's a very interesting paper, Treating Scrupulosity in Orthodox Jews, scrupulosity being another name for OCD that manifests in a religious setting. So look at what they write here. When treating religious patients, we believe it is not necessary or appropriate to include exposure to actual sin. Obsessional fears are usually driven more by actions that lead to increased, albeit small, risk than by actions that truly cause the feared consequence. I think the underline in bold was mine, not in the original. For example, patients who are afraid of touching a book on AIDS, leaving the house with the oven on, or handling knives around their baby, typically believe that these are risky behaviors, not ones that will definitely lead to the feared consequences. During exposure response prevention, it is helpful for patients to accept risks by acknowledging the possibility of their feared outcomes. But most individuals do not need to state that they are definitely going to get AIDS, burn their house down, or kill their child. Exposures do not usually require individuals actually to experience the ultimate negative consequences, but rather to tolerate risk, ambiguity, and uncertainty. Similarly, scrupulous patients need not actually sin or tell themselves they are doing so. Instead, they need to allow for slightly greater risk than others normally would without actually making the violation occur. So, you know, if you have somebody who is afraid in their kitchen that they might accidentally mix meat and milk, you don't have them mix meat and milk as part of the exposure response treatment. You may say, put some meat down on the meat counter, put some dairy down on the dairy counter, and even let them be right, you know, near each other. But that's not telling them to violate halacha. And that's an important point. And even if I give an example that makes somebody laugh, please, I want to make it crystal clear here. I don't find anything funny in it, and I know no one here does either. It's just that the examples are absurd, and therefore they lend themselves to people laughing. But I say that because I know that there is a certain lack of sensitivity to it at times, and I think that's important to defeat. But what we're seeing here is the second type of concern. Halacha may find the recommendations of the psychologist or the ideas promoted by the psychologist unacceptable within Judaism. And that's your second concern. I gave a shiur at Shai Shemayim last year, I'll probably do it at the Bayit at some point as well, called Mental Health and Mitzvot, where we dealt with resolving some of these conflicts. Where is it that halacha should be overridden, in fact, for the sake of treatment? And maybe when I send out links to other shiurim and the follow-up, I'll send out a link to that shiur, but I do expect to do it up north at some point as well. But that's our second concern. Our third concern out of the three is that even if the psychology is fine, they're not going to recommend anything prohibited, the ideas are not anti-Torah, nonetheless, the psychologist who doesn't believe could have a destructive influence. There is a prohibition in Judaism against learning that which is heretical in general. I brought you the passage from the Talmud based on the verse which is familiar to people from the Shema. Don't stray after your hearts refers to heresy. Don't stray after your eyes is thought of sin, immorality. Lest you stray is thought of idolatry. You're not allowed to look into those things. And the Rambam himself, Maimonides, writes, idolaters composed many books regarding idol worship, its deeds and rules. God commanded us not to read those books at all and not to wonder about any aspect of it. And not only may we not turn our thoughts after idolatry, but regarding any thought which could cause a person to uproot a Torah principle, we are warned not to bring it into our heart, not to turn our mind to it, thinking of it and being drawn after the thoughts of the heart, because a person's mind is limited and not all minds can grasp pure truth. In other words, what he's trying to say is, it's not that Judaism is afraid of other ideas, but Judaism recognizes that people are vulnerable. And for a whole host of reasons, they may be won over by an idea that is false. This happens all the time. Yes?
Well, then you would say, okay, you can't go to a secular university where you're going to be exposed to these ideas.
Bingo! Bingo! No, in all seriousness, this is the basis for opposition to secular university. And it's not, let me make this clear, as someone who went to a university and studied secular studies, let me be perfectly clear. This is not a resolved issue in Judaism. There are arguments for, there are arguments against. Take a look at number 23, please. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein those who are not aware, had a PhD in English literature, writes, it is, of course, a truism that dogma figures less prominently in Judaism than in Christianity, or to a lesser degree, Islam. But Mendelssohn's contention that it does not figure at all is patently false. We have dogma in Judaism. There are certain things that a Jew must believe. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad is a pasuk in the Torah. We do have to believe certain things. So the problem is, what happens when you put yourself in a situation, and in particular, a situation in which one is vulnerable, where you're going to be seeing a psychologist who is an authority figure, who is going to present other ideas. This is a real concern. You know, some rabbis went further with this and wrote about the early psychologists and their moral failings. I found that entertaining reading. But leave aside, that particular issue, there is a concern. You tell me now, within the treatment relationship, why is this such a concern? More of a concern, potentially, than reading a book that presents ideas that are secular. Why is it in the therapeutic relationship that this is a particular concern?
Because the relationship between transference and idolatry.
Transference. Transference is a big one. That's one. Sheldon, you were going to say?
It's coming from a personal relationship between the patient and the therapist. So the therapist's instructions have much more power.
Mm-hmm. Right, so the authority given to the therapist, and that's also where we're going with the transference. Also, the fact that, the trust that you have to have in order for this to work at all, otherwise why are you going?
When you read something, you don't have to trust your therapist. If you're in a therapeutic relationship with someone,
correct.
You must be trusted.
Right. There's a need.
And you're vulnerable at that point.
There's the vulnerability of the patient, also true. And then there's also the fact that this isn't like where you're just going to give somebody pills, right? You took a chest x-ray and you found something and you said, okay, here's what we're doing. It's all about dialogue, right? That's what you're building on. And even a behaviorist is working with dialogue. You know, there's no such thing as, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say there's no such thing because then someone will show me I'm wrong. But as a general rule, there has to be a relationship. It's not just based on action. Take a look at number 24, where Dr. Hoffman, in this book, Rabbanim Upsikologim Imut Vishituf Pi'ula, Rabbis and Psychologists, Confrontation and Partnership. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, past chief rabbi, meaning of the State of Israel, today the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, noted that the relationship between rabbis and psychologists resembles the relationship between halacha and medicine. But he emphasized the difference between an objective physician and a subjective psychologist. The psychologist does not function in a bubble, and part of his belief, his worldview, and his values influence his treatment approach. The worldview of the psychologist is going to come into the conversation. We're going to see that in Rav Moshe Feinstein shortly as well. And there is especially a fear of transference. So I brought you this great thing I found online, number 25, an exercise to explain transference. It's long, but I think it's worthwhile. This is what this professor Suler describes doing with his students. Think of your boyfriend / girlfriend or husband, wife, or a close friend. Think about some aspect of their personality that you have a strong reaction to, either positive or negative. Now write that down on a piece of paper. Describe what that aspect of their personality is like and how you react in your thoughts, feelings, and behavior toward that part of their personality. After the students are finished, I tell them to draw a box around what they have written and to write at the top of the box, is this transference? At this point, they're usually a bit puzzled. Now think about your parents. Is the personality characteristic of the person you wrote about and your reaction to it, is it a kind of replay or recreation of something that went on in your relationship with one or both of your parents? For example, does your parent have that same personality trait that you react to so strongly? Maybe this reaction to the person you described is a kind of transference from your relationship with your parent. Some students immediately see the connection, some will not. To increase the power and complexity of the exercise, I explain that the transference may be more tricky than simply reacting to the others the way you react to your parent. Here are several possibilities. You see the other in the same way as you believed your parent to have been. You see the other as being like what you wish your parent could have been like. You see the other as you were as a child, and you act like your parent did. You see the other as you were as a child, and you act like you wished your parent could have acted, and so on. It's where you transfer feelings that you have from one relationship into the relationship with the therapist. And then, of course, there's the opposite side of things, which we'll also talk about, which is countertransference, where the therapist starts to adopt elements of their other relationships in their dealings with the patient. This indeed is a cause for concern. And here's an interesting note in number 26, again from that article from Esther Hess. My experience and the clinical experience of my colleagues demonstrates that Haredi women are inclined to develop transference and intense dependency. She emphasizes in parentheses that this was not a clinical study. An additional and no less significant aspect is fear of elevation and esteem in transference. In the milieu of the Haredi community, an authority figure with knowledge and professional experience arouses honor and esteem. This is your problem. The element of esteem and respect, and yes, trust, as was mentioned before. So that's our third area of concern. Again, we've identified three areas of concern for psychology within Judaism. Number one, that you're putting psychology ahead of Torah as a resource. Number two, the psychology may conflict with halacha or hashkafa, what Judaism believes. And number three, the concern that the psychologist may personally promote things that are anti-halacha, and that the patient, having learned to trust and respect the psychologist, is going to follow. So you have a range of halachic rulings on this issue. You have some who argue all psychologists are out. Rabbi Menashe Klein, in his Mishnah Halachos, this is a response to someone who wrote him a letter. I didn't even bring Rabbi Klein's response to it. Just the part that's from the letter to him is sufficient. Watch what he says. Regarding the letter that His Honor published in London, titled Do Not Turn to the Yidonim in the Form of Psychologists, based on the biblical verse, Al Tifnu El HaYidonim. Yidonim are people who predict the future by reading bones, animal bones, and the like. So, this article quoted Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach that going to them causes great corruptions, and citing testimony in the name of the Chazon Ish that he said explicitly one should not go to them because they corrupt more than they repair. And such was the view of the Kilas Yaakov in several letters, and he never sent psychiatrists. And in a letter he received, he meaning His Honor, from the Beit Din of the Edah Haredit, he brought the Torah view that one must distance himself from them an arrow's distance. Their outlook and advice is against the Torah view and based on false ideas. And for any medical question for those who suffer from medical weakness, one should ask well-known halachic authorities who tremble at the word of God, who sit in judgment. And since he, the writer, heard that I am also against these psychologists, he wants to know where to find the letter I have written regarding this. Dot, dot, dot. When there's nothing vague about this. I should note a little bit of surprise regarding the Kilas Yaakov, the stipler, because he is quoted frequently for his sensitive answers regarding OCD, and there's no way that you give an answer without knowing that the patient is seeing a psychologist. In fact, the answers came through an observant psychologist living in Muncie at one point. I think he's in Israel now. He knew the patients were seeing psychologists, and he doesn't say, stop seeing this person. He gives answers for what they should be doing in terms of halachic obligations. So the Kilas Yaakov is an odd note. There are letters from the Kilas Yaakov I have to look into to get more regarding that. But the overall tenor here, I think, is very clear. Rav Sternbach, it will not surprise you, based on what we've already read, is also against, although he acknowledges that sometimes a rabbi might send someone there. He says, those who have chosen, number 28, those who have chosen the path of darkness without need, going to psychologists when sages of Torah did not counsel them to do it, did not see blessing from this. For only Torah is the way of life, one should not budge from it. And even though sometimes we see that a patient's mind is calm, his situation improves for a while when he speaks with a psychologist, in truth that is the fruit of his imagination. It's a placebo. At the moment when they explain to him that adhering to Torah scholars and righteous people is the right path, he will find that this will be pleasant for him and his state will improve. He will walk the straight, good, and true path. Dot, dot, dot. There are others who say it's not all psychologists, but the main concern is actually concern number three. It's the psychologist who is not observant. In other words, the strong view of don't go to them at all is really looking at our first and second concerns. The concern that you should be looking to Torah, and the concern that psychology is inherently no good. The rest of the views that oppose it, that we're going to see, are against it specifically if the practitioner is somebody who will be seen as as a threat. And that's the conclusion of Rabbi Froman, who I mentioned before. It's also the conclusion of Moshe Feinstein. Take a look at source number 29. Regarding those of ill spirits and thoughts who need to go to psychologists and psychiatrists, whether they may go to heretics, that's the question that's been put to him. I use the word heretic because it's the best translation for the terms that are used in Hebrew. I'm not getting into what constitutes heresy. In my humble opinion, one should not go to such doctors to be healed. Since these cures are not from medication which heals, but rather than via a lot of speech with the patient, they come to know what thoughts he suffers from, and they advise him how to act, there certainly is concern that they may advise him from time to time against the laws of Torah, and even against the fundamentals of the religion, and against prishut and sniut, right? Laws of sexual separation. And if they are expert doctors and they promise the parents they will not speak things which are against the ideas of faith and the Torah's mitzvot, perhaps one could depend on them. Since they are experts, they will not lie. He says when you have somebody who, well, it's more about being a professional than about being an expert. In other words, there's a lot riding on them telling the truth here. They could get themselves in trouble if they say one thing and then do another. So he says, then you can trust them. Therefore, one should search for a psychiatrist who observes Torah. If there is none, they should stipulate with him, and he should promise not to speak to the patient in matters of faith and Torah, which may be easier said than done. Right? You have to go back, said then done, because you have to go back to the point that we raised before. What if psychology really does mandate that you look at matters of faith and Torah? What if it really can be about their relationship with religion? So then you have to go back to what I did at Shari Shemayim last year in the question of at what point you're willing to override halakha for the needs of the patient. What level of illness are we talking about? What kind of illness? What kind of treatment? So again, I'm going to send out that mental health and mitzvot link because I think that that's a necessary partner to this. But I will also show you number 30, I didn't need to bring anything from the responsum, because the point is not the text of the responsum itself. Rav Usher Weiss has a responsum in number 30 dealing with OCD. And there it's very clear that he has no problem working with psychologists on issues like this. He doesn't speak out against it. His point is simply regarding their advice, how one should practice it. Rav Sternbach himself gets quoted in an essay by Rabbi Naftali Bar Ilan from a conversation at a conference where he was asked, Rav Sternbach was asked, are you really that staunch against this? And his answer was, not necessarily. If you have a doctor who is God-fearing, then you could go to such a doctor. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach is quoted to this effect in the Sefer Ba'alehu Lo Yibol, but I couldn't find it online, and so I wasn't able, I don't have a hard copy, so I wasn't able to retype it, but the quote is, I'm told that that's what he said in Ba'alehu Lo Yibol. Until I see it inside, I won't feel comfortable putting it on a source sheet based on someone's statement of what he said. But Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, in source number 32, flip the page to see my translation, says, there are situations in which psychiatry and psychology can help and even cure. Therefore, one should not reject such treatment where there is a need, despite the stigma against such therapy. One should not be treated by psychologists who are heretical, for there is concern lest they advise against the Torah. By the way, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg will be here at the Bayit God Willing Shabbos, February 8th, speaking multiple times. Take advantage of the opportunity. He is both a neurologist and one of the world's leading authorities on medical halacha and Jewish medical ethics. The last source within this section is from a Chabad website, in number 33, from the Beis Din of Crown Heights. The questioner asked them, why is it that rabbis keep talking about psychology these days? Historically, we never turn to psychologists. So he says, there is an assumption implicit in your question that rabbanim in the past have not used psychology. I think that's a misuse of the word implicit. I think he meant explicit. But anyway, this is not the case. Though the specific field of psychology as an independent subject of study and practice has been formally developed only in the 1870s, the concept existed before, and we have many examples of great rabbanim who made use of its services, e.g. the Rebbe Rashab consulted Freud, which I don't know anything about, but that's what he says. One of the Lubavitcher Rebbe's consulted Freud. Yeah?
They mentioned a doctor at Vienna,
interesting.
And Freud mentions him in his writing, not by name.
Interesting. Okay. Freud mentions him too. All right. As for the further developments in the world of psychology, this is no different than developments in the field of medicine, where we make use of them on the basis of what Chazal told us, Yesh Chochma Bagoyim Ta'amin, that if someone tells you that there is an idea among the nations, not Torah, there's an idea, that they've developed some idea, believe them. They're wise too. True, we need to be particularly cautious when it comes to the discipline of psychology, as it can involve reliance on doctrines which are inconsistent with Torah. At the same time, it should be noted that this issue is less a concern with psychology of today as opposed to yesteryear, since it is much more scientific than philosophical. Still, we must exercise caution and proceed only with advice of a Rav, etc. I found that interesting, the scientific versus philosophical. That's one that bears discussion another time when we have more than 8 minutes left.
Tanya is 100% CBD.
Yeah? Interesting. Okay. He said that Tanya is 100% CBT. I assume he was saying CBT, not CBD. It sounded like he said CBT there. Okay, that's another story. We had a share on that. I would also add one other note, which is from the Tiferes Yisrael, Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz. The Rambam, on the one hand, we read before, did not like the study of secular philosophy. On the other hand, the Rambam studied it and taught it in the Mora Nevuchim. So various writers have tried to square that circle and figure out what's going on there. And the Tiferes Yisrael says there's a difference between reading it regularly, making that what you immerse yourself in, and reading it occasionally. And he says, if you are a believer, you don't have to be so concerned. And you need to know how to respond to a heretic, so you may need to read it. At the same time, I'm not sure that that's meant for a vulnerable population. Going to somebody who is going to talk to you about ideas that are antithetical to Judaism, I'm not sure that he would support it. But here's the key to me. After all is said and done on all of these different points of views, if you really are opposed to it, what other solution are you offering? We said in the beginning, there is an obligation for patients to seek treatment. There is an obligation also for us to try to heal people. So if you don't want them to go to psychologists, what exactly are you doing in order to take care of the people who are dealing with depression, people who are dealing with anxiety, people who are dealing with schizophrenia, all sorts of psychosis? Where is your solution? Because until you're going to come up with one, this may well be the necessity to save lives. So I think that's a really critical question to be asking here. So turning back to our vignette number one, do you send this woman to a therapist who's not observant when you don't have observant therapists around? So clearly there's a preference, we've seen it, for those who are observant as therapists. And it's valid for therapeutic reasons. Something that somebody said in the very beginning, down at that end of the table, but I couldn't see who it was, noted that you really want to have clinicians who are familiar with the sensitivities, lifestyle, experiences of an observant Jew, just in order to know what is normal. I brought you a few sources from Treating Scrupulosity in Orthodox Jews that speak to this, right? Just take 35. Appropriate behavior is environmentally determined, and just as healthy surgeons wash their hands relatively often, it may be the case that people in certain cultures or religious groups are slightly more bothered by intrusive thoughts. So you have to know your environment. When someone says that my intrusive thoughts are bothering me, I think that it's going to come true because I thought it, you have to know where they're coming from, because that's going to bias their belief about the importance of and the weight to be given to a person's thoughts. And again, I'm going to send out, as part of sending out the follow-up email, there's a plug for signing in with your email address. I'll send out a link to my Shiurim on OCD, so you'll see more of this material there. But we want there to be a religious therapist. It's true. That's something that we consider important. What about, though, the concern for transference by the patient and counter-transference by the therapist because of their shared religious beliefs and their shared religious experience? So I'm going to be brief with this, but I do want to make sure to address this, and I may go a minute or two over. We did a long introduction, so maybe that's fair. I don't know. So this is a valid concern. There is transference that can be helpful. Don't assume that all transference is bad. I brought you a source from Purdue University, number 38, that seems to speak about transference in a more positive light. However, it can be damaging for the therapeutic process, for the patient. It may bring in other issues that aren't relevant to the treatment. right? What if the patient starts to see the religious therapist, especially one who incorporates Torah, as a substitute for their rabbi, and all their hostile feelings toward their rabbi are now directed towards the therapist? Or all the baggage they have for Judaism may come into play in their relationship with the therapist. And countertransference is also a problem. Spiro notes it in number 39. The therapist may start to have feelings, because this is a fellow Jew, because this is somebody who's observant, of rescue fantasy. They may go to excess in trying to take care of the patient. They may become frustrated when the treatment isn't working. All of these are problems as well. The patient may have unrealistic expectations from the therapist, but Spiro argues that countertransference can be managed. He believes that transference and countertransference can be managed. He says you have to be alert to it. And he argues in number 40 that it's better to have an observant therapist who understands the patient and speaks the patient's language and is dealing with the transference issues, as opposed to having a therapist who has no idea where the patient is coming from and trying to train them and sensitize them to the milieu and background of the religious patient. So how do you deal with it? So Spiro recommends that that first of all, don't debate theology with the patient. Just make sure that that's not where you end up. That's a bad idea. Even if the patient brings up theology, you don't want to be in that position. Direct them to their rabbi. That's number one. Number two, he talks about the therapeutic barrier. Trying to the extent possible not to identify yourself in this actively as somebody with religious commonalities. I think that's hard. He quotes a fellow by the name of Holt. He suggests calibrating your reaction so that you can account for it, and using your supervision of yourself, use your reactions as a means of diagnosing the patient's feelings, so that effectively your countertransference becomes a means of analyzing the patient. It becomes an asset for the treatment. In truth, we have literature on cases in which rabbis have worked with psychologists despite all the suspicion that we saw above. I mentioned the Kilas Yaakov and his work for patients with OCD, but there's a lot in various articles, including some in this Hebrew book, about psychologists and rabbis working together. In number 42, I brought you Yirat Tahara. Yirat Tahara is a pamphlet put out in Bnei Brak, for dealing with issues of what's called in Yiddish nerven, anxiety, and halachic dispensations for people who are dealing with anxiety. Rabbi Yisrael Gans is a Rosh Hashiva of Kol Torah in Yerushalayim. And Rabbi Dr. Victor Bancha quotes him in Religious Compulsions and Fears, talking about what patients should do when they are dealing with compulsions as part of OCD. And he talks about the importance of leniency. He's definitely understanding that you're working with psychologists. So I think in practice, yes, there may be concerns in having a religious therapist in terms of some of the issues of transference, counter-transference that may come up. But in practice, it seems to me that halachic authorities much prefer that. And from a practical perspective, it would seem to be the preferred approach. Not necessarily the point, though, of saying, if you don't have that, don't go to anyone. Rav Moshe Feinstein himself took the position of, get them to guarantee you that they're not going to, he's dealing with a case where you're sending a child where there are particular vulnerabilities, get them to tell you that they're not going to speak in matters of faith, and then send to them, because he understands the level of need that's involved. I didn't even get to vignette number two, but I'm going to state something about it. It's about using Torah in psychological treatment. There is so much to say on that front, but I just want to show you the two sources that I brought here about how rabbis can help in support roles. One was Rabbi Shlomo Wolbe, who I mentioned earlier, in number 44, where he talks about rabbis on the one hand knowing their limits, but also getting trainings that they'll recognize issues when they see them. He talks about how ignorance causes a delay in connecting the ill with psychiatric treatment. Relatives, friends, educators notice someone is suffering, behaving oddly. It doesn't enter their mind that they're seeing a case of emotional illness. this. More than occasionally, they advise a depressed youth to marry early. Sometimes that's good advice, but not in the case of manic depression and the like. Only a psychiatrist can determine this. He was very strong in his support of getting rabbis getting professional training and recognizing the limits of that training. The other piece that I wanted to quote, I'm sorry, just because I'm over time, I want to make sure that I say this also. Number 45 is also significant for Rabbi Aryeh Levine. From the biography Ish Tzadik Haya, where apparently the head of neurology at Hadassah Hospital was sending him people who were dealing with mental illness. And his solution for them was that he would listen to them and he would show them empathy. And that apparently went a very long way in terms of helping them. There are things that one can do, even if one doesn't have that that level of sophistication. But rabbis can be supportive in this regard for a therapist who believes that Torah can be useful in addressing the needs of the patient. There's so much more to say. I brought the last couple of sources on some of the hazards of using Torah in therapy. But I think what we're going to do, God willing, is we're going to have a part two, because we have to. There's so much more to talk about, but I'm going to stick around for questions. Please make sure that you signed in so you get a follow-up email on this, especially if you want credit, because otherwise I can't give you credit. But also I have these books up here, and I'd suggest please taking a look at them. They're really worthwhile. Thank you very much.